Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling Southeast Asia's digital finance scene, aiming to give you, the business strategist, a real shortcut. We're pulling insights straight from the latest Economy SEA 2025 report. That's the one from Google, Temasek, and Bain. Our mission, simple. Cut through all that data, find the actionable stuff you need for your strategy over the next, say, 5 years. And the scale we're talking about here is, well, it's vast. Southeast Asia's digital economy, it's booming. It's actually on track to blow past $300 billion in gross merchandise value just this year. And what's really striking is that this is 1.5 times bigger than what they predicted just 10 years back. So we're seeing steady, strong, double-digit growth, around, what, 15% year on year?
Yeah, that overall picture is definitely strong. Impressive momentum. But look, for strategists trying to figure out where the real value is being built, the focus has got to shift, and shift fast, to digital financial services. DFS, I mean, the investment community, they've pretty much shown us the way already. If you just look at the funding data, say, over the last 12 months, DFS pulled in something like 45 to 50% of all private funding in the digital economy.
Wow, okay. Almost half. Half of every single investment dollar funneling into digital finance. That's a huge concentration.
It really is. Especially, you know, when you stack it up against the year before. Back then, DFS was maybe around 30% of the total funding.
Mm.
So this jump, it tells us a couple of things pretty clearly. One, the basic payment systems are mostly in place. They're built.
Yeah.
And two, investors are now really pouring money into the layers on top of payments, the stuff that actually generates revenue.
Okay. So that's our job today, then, in this deep dive. Map out that expansion. We need to unpack how DFS is evolving beyond just simple payments, getting into higher value stuff like lending, wealth management, and maybe most importantly, pinpoint those core strategic hurdles. You mentioned trust earlier. That seems like a big one. We need to see what needs solving to make that, what, $500 billion investment bet actually pay off.
Right. And to really grasp where things are headed, you've got to start with the foundation, which is payments. The digital payments part of SEA, it's actually getting pretty mature now. And interestingly, it's less about disruptive startups these days and more about governments working together across borders. The headline here is really connectivity. Think about this. Every single ASEAN 10 country now has its own national unified QR system. We just saw the last couple come online recently. Myanmar with MMQR, Brunei with Turis QR, both in 2025. But the real kicker, it's the cross-border stuff. 8 of these national QR systems, they're now linked, interconnected. That's largely thanks to the Regional Payment Connectivity Initiative, the RPC. It's got 9 central banks signed up now.
The RPC. Right, that's not just some policy paper then. It's actual infrastructure changing the whole scale. Let's look at the numbers for ASEAN 10 this year. Digital payments, GTV, gross transaction value, it's huge. Estimated around $1.4 trillion. And digital payments make up, what, 61% of total transaction GTV? That's a massive shift from cash.
It's a huge shift, absolutely. But here's where it gets interesting strategically. It creates this tension, right, for the payment platforms, even the newer e-wallets. Because while this massive adoption drives incredible volume, trillions of dollars, it's also squeezing margins. We're seeing those weighted average merchant discount rates, MDRs, you know, the fee merchants pay per transaction, they're actually going down by about 0.05 percentage points every year.
0.05. Okay, that sounds tiny. 5 basis points. But on $1.4 trillion in GTV, 5 basis points is, well, that's a lot of money shifting hands. That margin pressure must really hurt the incumbents.
Oh, you feel it straight away. As people move to cheaper options, like QR codes and e-wallets, the platforms have to fight harder on fees. But here's the paradox. Despite QR and e-wallets being cheaper, faster, credit cards, they're proving surprisingly sticky.
Really? But isn't the whole idea of these digital ecosystems to kind of push cards aside? Are you saying even with better tech and lower costs, people in places like, say, Singapore or Thailand are just too locked into their old card habits or the rewards?
For some groups, yeah, definitely. It's partly habit, deeply ingrained, but it's also those banks and card networks. They are masters at building reward ecosystems, loyalty programs, trying to replicate that deep long-term loyalty with just digital perks. That's proving really tough, even for the big regional super apps with deep pockets.
Okay, so if payments are getting mature, volumes are huge, but margins are shrinking. That suggests the real money, the investment focus, is elsewhere. Let's switch gears then. Talk about the big revenue driver, digital lending. The report says lending is still the biggest piece of the DFS revenue pie, right?
That's right. It is. Yeah. Now, growth there is expected to slow down just a touch in 2025. Partly macro conditions, partly some new regulations kicking in.
Yeah.
But the strategy now isn't just raw volume. It's more surgical. targeted. We're seeing sort of three main approaches. First, still focusing on those underserved segments, people traditional banks often miss. That continues steadily. Second, and this is strategically much bigger, is embedded finance.
Embedded finance. Okay, break that down quickly for us. What makes an embedded loan different, maybe more successful than just a standard digital loan application?
Right. So a good embedded loan feels almost invisible. It's offered right when and where you need it. It becomes part of the service you're already using. Think about, say, a small merchant on an e-commerce site suddenly gets a big order, needs cash for inventory fast. Instead of going off to a bank website, filling forms, stop, boom, the platform offers a working capital loan right there based on their recent sales data, instantly available. It's designed to keep that merchant selling on the platform. It helps the platform make money too.
Got it. And that sounds like it connects directly to the third strategy you mentioned, using data. These digital banks, the super apps, they're seeing really strong loan book growth, double digits, by using all this unique user data they have.
Absolutely. It's not just about credit scores anymore. They're looking at everything.
Right.
Ecosystem partnerships give them data on payment history, sure, but also transport rides, maybe even chat activity within the app. It's this proprietary data, this sort of digital footprint that gives them an edge in underwriting, especially for customers who don't have a long credit history with traditional banks. They can assess risk differently.
And importantly, you're saying this embedded lending, using ecosystem data, it's also aimed squarely at SMEs, small businesses, like offering working capital on the spot to merchants or maybe even delivery drivers on the platform, solving that immediate cash flow headache.
Exactly. It's a huge pain point for SMEs.
Yeah.
And for the platform lending the money, it potentially lowers the risk. You're lending based on real-time business activity that you can actually see happening within your own system.
Okay, lending is key. What about digital wealth? That seems to be scaling up fast, too. The report mentions multiple digital wealth platforms hitting over $1 billion in assets under management AUM. And the total AUM across the region is forecast at, what, $91 billion by end of 2025? How are they managing that customer journey, though? Taking someone from just, say, putting savings in to buying fractional shares of stock, that feels like a big jump in trust and financial know-how needed.
Yeah, it is a leap. But their approach is very deliberate. Step by step, the initial hook, simplicity, low fees, easy digital sign-up, that gets people in the door. But the journey itself is crucial. They start customers off with things like high-yield cash management accounts, basically fancy digital savings with a good rate, very low risk. Once you're comfortable, you trust the app with your cash. Then they start gently nudging you towards slightly higher risk things, upselling you to manage portfolios, maybe fractional shares, these curated investment themes they put together. It's like climbing a ladder. They build trust on that first safe rung.
Makes sense. And before we hit the big challenge section, just quickly, digital insurance. Sounds like it's following that exact same embedded playbook.
Precisely the same logic. The data is pretty clear. Super apps see much, much higher take-up rates for those tiny embedded insurance products. You know, the kind of offered when you buy something online, book a flight, or even take a rideshare. Add on accident cover for 20 cents, that sort of thing. Compare that to trying to sell the same policy as a standalone product. Almost no one buys it. Why? Embedding just removes the friction. One extra tap when you're already paying, easy. Seeking it out separately, too much effort. For high volume, low cost insurance, embedding is everything.
Okay, so we've got the growth picture, the massive scale, the trillions in transactions. Now, let's dig into what feels like the core strategic problem, the thing that could slow down this next phase of DFS growth, the trust challenge. Because even with everyone using these services, the market feels really fragmented, lots of players, very competitive.
Yeah, and the data throws up this, well, it's a real paradox around loyalty. Should definitely be keeping CEOs up at night. Basically, consumers say they don't trust these digital finance players nearly as much as they trust their traditional banks. That's point one. Point two, they use multiple e-wallets all the time, hopping between them, which suggests, you know, there isn't much deep loyalty or perceived unique value.
Okay, less trust than banks, jumping between apps. And wasn't there something about credit needs, the big stuff?
That's maybe the most telling part. For the e-wallets dreaming of becoming full banks, a really significant chunk of consumers say flat out, my e-wallet provider, not my first choice if I need serious credit, like a big loan or a mortgage. Forget it.
Ouch. So convenience wings for small everyday things, buying coffee, paying a bill. But when the stakes are high, people still default back to the old established banks, that perceived safety net.
Seems like it. Trust is still deeply tied to those legacy institutions for the big financial decisions. Convenience gets you the daily transaction, but trust gets you the mortgage.
And this lack of deep trust becomes even more critical when we think about the next big wave, AI, using AI to manage finances, make decisions, agentic transactions, they call it. But here, Southeast Asia's basic payment plumbing throws a spanner in the works compared to, say, the US or Europe. Because SEA just isn't a card-heavy market, is it? In huge places like Indonesia, Laos, Myanmar, cards make up, what, less than 10% of payment value? Totally different from Singapore, where it's maybe 70, 80% cards.
Exactly. And that fundamental difference, the non-card reality, it has massive implications for rolling out AI in finance. Globally, the big payment companies, they're building agentic AI capabilities mostly on top of existing card networks, Visa, MasterCard. But in SEA, where everyone's using national QR codes and e-wallets, that global approach just doesn't fit. The rails are different. So what does that mean? It means there's a huge need for local innovation, homegrown solutions. If the global giants are focused on cards, then SEA businesses have to figure out how to build AI agents that work seamlessly with QR codes, with local e-wallets, with digital ID systems. If you're a strategist thinking about where to put your R&D money right now, building that secure layer connecting AI to local ID and those QR payment systems, that's the critical bottleneck. That's what unlocks secure, high-value AI delegation here.
Okay, so let's try and wrap this deep dive up. It's clear DFS is where the action is, where the investment is pouring in. It's growing fast, getting more complex. We've got this huge foundation, $1.4 trillion in digital payments GTV, heading towards $100 billion in lending and wealth AUM.
Yep, and that foundation looks pretty solid, mainly thanks to all that regional QR and interoperability really taking off. But the next big jump, expanding into sophisticated wealth management, integrating AI. That really hangs on solving two big things. One, bridging that consumer trust gap versus traditional banks. Two, getting smarter about using that unique ecosystem data to offer genuinely better embedded products, especially for SMEs.
All right, so let's end with a final thought for you, our listeners, to mull over. Something straight from the report's findings. Consumers in Southeast Asia, they're actually showing a really high willingness, globally speaking, to use AI for everyday tasks, for convenience. So the question is, could AI-driven hyper-personalization finance offers perfectly tailored using real-time behavior data, could that be the key? Could that finally build the deep trust needed to shift loyalty, even for big decisions like loans and investments, away from the old banks? Moral worries about transparency, about control over algorithms, making money decisions. Will those fears mean AI just stays a helpful assistant, never quite becoming a truly trusted partner for our major financial choices? Something to think about.